one can only do so much in 40 or 45 minutes. So I have decided to cover basically three areas, the first being the nature and levels and so on of bibliographic and other reference tools, the second being a specific consideration of indexes and series, and the third being a consideration of biblical exegesis and commentaries, because we have quite a few questions pertaining to those areas. This will be not only theoretical and general and broad as an overview in these areas, but also will hopefully be practical and address the specific needs that you may have, and especially give you clues as to the specific use and uses and the how-to use of various reference tools in particular. So I would like to, first of all, pass out this handout, which partly a diagram and a set of lists, to kind of give you an idea of what we mean by reference tools, and especially bibliographical ones. Reference departments of libraries can be very threatening to the uninitiated, and for that matter, to experienced scholars sometimes, because there's a wealth of material, and the challenge is to find it and then unlock it. And those are two separate steps. Notice up in the upper right, I have here kind of, this is the theoretical part of the lecture, the very theoretical. Whatever exists and happens. Of whatever exists and happens, there is the record of whatever exists and happens. Obviously, a lot of things exist and happen of which there are no record or records. Then, of what is recorded, of what exists and happens, there is that part that's published. And I use that in the largest sense of the word. Issued, put out, distributed in some kind of form, usually meaning some kind of mass form, more than one copy written by someone. That would be a manuscript. But it could be a mimeographed item, it could be reproduced cassettes, you know, anything that's issued. It doesn't necessarily have to be copyrighted and, you know, bound or whatever. And you notice within that, I put dashed lines around that word publication and gave you some examples of things that are published, books, articles, tape material, theses, journals. You could go on and on. You could publish, there's what's called realia in library work, which is like kits and things, especially in public libraries and school libraries, where those things are, in effect, mass-produced and published with subject headings to them and so on. And the kit comes with, if it's on the Civil War, there will be coins from the period and posters from the period and a layout of the Battle of Gettysburg topographically. You know, that kind of thing can, in a sense, be published material. But more often we think of books and journal articles, and now more and more these days of non-print media as well, video cassettes and so on. Then in the record of what happens, there's oral tradition, memory, photographs, letters. Now, letters can be published, or they can just be in their original form. Papers, tapes, notes. Now, over there at the left under reference tools, there are two basic types. One is bibliographical, and one is informational. Now, you notice there's a two-way street between the bibliographic reference tools and published material. Between informational reference tools, there is a one-way street, as it were, from whatever exists and happens and what is recorded over to the informational tools. In other words, the information is funneled over and put into some kind of published, recorded form, and then that in turn becomes part of this publication of what is recorded. Examples underneath there, almanacs, yearbooks, dictionaries, encyclopedias, directories, guides, and so on. These are not keys to further literature, like the bibliographical part of reference tools. tools. You see the distinction? Almanacs, encyclopedias, and so on, they give you the data itself, that what you're looking for, the answers, the information about what exists and happens. So an encyclopedia article on Karl Barth would tell you about him, whereas a bibliography of works about Barth would not tell you about Barth. The bibliographical type of reference tool would be a key to unlock that first-hand material that does give you the information. So in other words, there could be bibliographies of the informational tools, which there are. There could be bibliographies of bibliographies. We'll get to that in a minute. But let me first of all give you some examples of the informational tools, of which I did not bring very many. But here is one, the Westminster Dictionary of Christian Education. I'll refer to that again. Here's a library resources for the blind and physically handicapped. In a sense, that's an informational tool, telling you where those collections are housed and so on. Here is a standard work. You notice standard works at the bottom there. They're put there simply because often basic sources of material are part of a reference collection. They're not like almanacs and encyclopedias. They're not reference in that sense. They're reference only in the sense that they present the standard distilled form of material of some kind. For example, a rather specialized one, the standard scholarly work for the Samaritan Pentateuch. This is it. There may be popular editions of the Samaritan Pentateuch. There may be various uncritical editions of it. But this would be your standard work type of reference tool, and thus it's on reference up in the library. So if you want to do a scholarly paper that relates to the Samaritan Pentateuch, you'd want this, you know, not something that's more removed or uncritical as an edition. So under informational, I'm including that kind of reference tool, as well as the directories, guides, almanacs, and biography tools, and so on. Moving over then to bibliographical reference tools, there are basically two types. One is enumerative, and the other is subject bibliography. Enumerative, don't let that throw you. It simply means a listing, but the key is that it is not by subject. Subject is not a concern. So let's give you some examples there, starting with universal to local. Now, that doesn't mean, that represents a gradation there. It doesn't mean that a bibliography is both universal and regional and local. It means that it can be any one of those. A local bibliography would be one of all of the books published in Montgomery County for a given time period. We'll get to these other considerations, such as time period and so on, in a minute. A universal one would be one embracing everything published everywhere. And there hardly are any such. Just think a minute why. You're talking about all time. You're talking about all languages. Therefore, usually universal is circumscribed in some way. This is the National Union Catalog. It represents holdings of the Library of Congress and other libraries around the United States, thus the word union, catalog for the holdings, and union because it's not just Library of Congress, it's other libraries too. But it's just U.S. Libraries, basically. Up to 1956, so this would be 1955 and before. This is volume 430. They were in the O's. So this size volume runs up 800 and some volumes, giving you what was held by these libraries, and on each page, of course, are more well over a dozen entries. And, of course, there are hundreds of pages for each of the volumes. So you're talking about millions and millions of published items. And this would be a universal bibliography in the sense that it's whatever is held by all those libraries. In other words, it's not just English material. It's not just things published in the United States. There's Chinese script in here for those kinds of works, and Cyrillic script and Arabic script and so on for those works. Obviously, English constitutes a vast majority of the entries. But these are basically reproductions of catalog cards, if you're wondering what these lines are, and these blocks of print. Basically reproductions of the cataloging for each of these items. 800 some volumes, that's just up through 1955, and that's just as issued by by the Library of Congress to represent its own holdings and those of scores of other libraries around the country that contributed data on their holdings. Then that's also, in a sense, you notice the next one is a national bibliography. That is, in a sense, our national bibliography, too. Not that it's just U.S. material, but that it's U.S. holdings. Notice the first was geographic. Universal, as I said, could be time period, could be language-oriented. We'll get to those down below here in a minute, but I'm kind of interpreting that in a geographic sense. These little bracketed terms to the right there are just to kind of give you an idea. National would be political. There's a similar set like this of hundreds of volumes for the British Museum Library, now the British Libraries. A similar one for the French, and so on. So those would be the national bibliographies. Then library catalogs. This is, in a sense, a catalog of all the libraries, or most of them, many of them. Some of you may have heard of the Union Seminary catalog, or the Missionary Research Library catalog. Those would be catalogs of just individual libraries. So I say professional here in that what's in the catalog has been determined over a period of decades by professional librarians, and possibly relates to a profession, such as medicine or missions. If a medical library took all of its cards out, for not the subject cards and everything, but like just for an author card for each of its books, and put those onto pages like this and published it in volumes like this, it would be a library catalog of that medical library. In that sense, it's professional. Or the Union Seminary Library's theological. Professional in the sense of being developed, the catalog and the collection being developed by librarians and also representing one area of study. The Missionary Research Library is a prime example of a special library catalog. And there are publishers such as G.K. Hall that specialize in putting these things out. Then there's the trade or commercial catalog. Before I get to those, here's a single library catalog. This is the Reiner Recording Library catalog. This is just the cassette holdings of one library, Union Seminary in Richmond, Virginia. So this would be an example of a library catalog, not a union one, but just the individual one, like the Missionary Research Library or Union Seminary catalog that I just mentioned. And this would not be their book holdings. It's their cassette collection published in catalog form. The commercial enumerative bibliography is represented by books in print. This is everything printed in the United States in those years. This is just one of the four volumes, titles L to Z, titles beginning with L through Z. Nothing that's out of print, nothing that's published in Europe, Africa, Asia, just U.S., but not necessarily just English. Spanish publishers in the U.S., you know, those Spanish titles would be in here. But it's a trade bibliography. Again, as we're going through this, you see in the enumeration, there's nothing to do with subject. These cassettes could be on anything. What's in here is on everything. This is everything. You know, not even any refinement in terms of significance. These would somewhat represent a refinement in terms of significance, because the librarians wouldn't have put them in the library unless they were significant for some purpose or scholarly or something. There's not even that criterion here. Children's literature, ephemeral literature, things published that are really, you know, just junk stuff, as well as highly scholarly stuff. There's no selectivity in that respect. In that sense, it's just a trade catalog. That's why I have the word trade here. This is a kind of trade catalog, but this is what you should have in your library. It's a listing of periodicals. Notice here we're dealing with cassettes, periodicals, books, not just talking in these enumerations of enumerative bibliographies about books alone. Then I have their serial directories. Now, there you have a distinction. It's just serials or periodicals. It's not other things, too. And so that's a form, you know, the form of the literature that's enumerated is a criterion. And then usually some other criterion. I left that blank there. Form plus commercial, like everything, every serial that's put out by some publisher, or professional, you know, medical serials directory, and so on. This is Ulrichs International Periodicals Directory. This would be tend to be your more scholarly periodicals and your more standard established periodicals. You've all seen, I remember, Joe McAvaney just in the last few days sent us volume one, number one of a little periodical called The Liberty Bell. Well, that wouldn't be in here, but that's how easy it is to issue a periodical. In a sense, it's almost easier to start issuing a periodical than a book, and some periodicals never get beyond the first few issues or even one issue. In fact, I think the first periodical ever published in the United States ended after issue one. You know, it's kind of a classic debate. Was it a periodical? But this, right, it should be a monograph, which is everything but everything else that's not periodical, they often say humorously, but with a great deal of wisdom, too. But this would be both U.S. and non-U.S. Periodicals. Here's hematology. They say, see medical sciences-hematology. So under that, you'd find your hematology periodicals. There's absolutely every kind of name of periodicals. It's amusing sometimes just to look through the lists of them because of the specialization. You know, one will be entitled Brain. There's a periodical entitled Brain. There's a periodical entitled Mind. The Mind one happens to be in philosophy. The Brain one happens to be in medicine. There's just a wide variety. Now, union lists, serials, holdings, lists. This is limited by form, that is the form being the serial, and professional interest. In other words, again, librarians or someone has selected these. This is a union list of the Seminary Libraries Consortium of which we are a part. And you should be familiar with it. It's right up there at the front of the periodical room on the little table. It gives you the titles and other data about the periodical, when it began, what it was succeeded by, what it was preceded by, and so on. And then the holdings. It's a union list, meaning a union listing of who has it and what volumes they have, what years. Invaluable tool. But again, it's enumerative. It's subject related only because it's from theological libraries, but there's no attempt here to gear it just to theology periodicals. It's, if they have medical periodicals at those libraries, then they're in here too. Dissertation lists. I don't have an example here, but dissertation abstracts would be a classic example. Again, there's a form limitation. It lists just dissertations. And dissertations usually are not considered to be published material. So again, you get into the rough line around what is really considered to be published. Then guides to bibliography, determined by the form and the use. This is Bob Keppel's reference works for theological research, which I helped, which I read the manuscript of. And he has done quite a good job here annotating each of the entries that he gives. But it doesn't include commentaries. It doesn't include the standard text of the Septuagint or the Vulgate and so on. It's more your bibliographic and reference tool type of thing. You know, listing your periodical indexes, listing your theological word books, and so on. So it's kind of a guide to bibliography. A bibliography of bibliographies, represented here by Constance Winchell, now published, edited by Eugene Sheehy, but it is standard. It's referred to in library circles as Winchell or Sheehy. It's called Guide to Reference Books. But it would embrace all of the world of learning. In other words, every area of study. So this would be a primary source for the humanities, the sciences, each of the humanities and fine arts and so on, and would give you a breakdown. And it would include encyclopedias and some of these informational tools and some of the standard work type of tools, as well as bibliographical tools. So in a very strict sense, it's not a bibliography of bibliographies, but a huge proportion of it is a listing of bibliographies. In that sense, it's a universal bibliography of bibliographies. Again, language, place of publication, and so on would not be particularly important criteria for inclusion. Now, looking over then at subject bibliographies, that's much more easy to understand than enumerative because it's more familiar. Usually think of a bibliography, it's on something, you know, it's Excuse me, let me back up. I forgot biobibliography. That, and I have in brackets there, personal. That's at the bottom of the column of enumerative bibliographies. That simply is a list of everything published by a person, an individual person. Here is William Foxwell Albright's comprehensive definitive bibliography. I'm working on one now for Dr. McCrae, and it's an enormous task, which I kind of wish that you hadn't been involved with. I'm trying to annotate his. The annotations take three-fourths of the time because you have to kind of go through the material and then put in two or three sentences what it's about. But this is unannotated, but it basically lists all the books he publishes. There are different formats. We'll get down here to arrangement and format, different kinds of considerations that you have to think of in using all of these tools. But here are his books by year, 1938, 1935, 38, 39, 40, 41, 42, 43, 46, you know, and under each of the years, the titles of the books that he published. Then the articles in scholarly journals, again. Now, under each year, of course, there's a slew of them, because obviously a person can crank out a number more articles than he can full books. Then there's a section on all of his book reviews. But do you see, it's enumerative, because if he wrote an article on counseling, it would not be excluded because it wasn't on archaeology and he was an archaeologist. It's a biobibliography. It's enumerative because it just gives you whatever he wrote. And again, whatever he wrote or published, some of them will include letters. McCrae's is going to include letters because a lot of his production is non-published. But some of it will be just the books and articles, and it won't get into other, you know, published lectures and papers and things. But it's a biobibliography. And if you're studying a person, one of the most valuable things to have is a biobibliography. You're studying Albright, his life and work. Much better to have this on hand and go to all your original sources. That's from his own mouth, you know. You don't have to rely on secondary sources as you study him and interact with his work and critique it and so on. So biobibliographies are marvelous, but because of the amount of work and the fame a person has to achieve, often they are hard to come by. Limited audiences, they're not, you know, widely distributed like some books are and so on. Over then to subject bibliographies, my arrangement here has tried to convey the idea of general to special. And I think that if you keep in mind that both enumerative and subject bibliographies and informational tools, clear across the spectrum of reference tools, there's a gradation from general to specific. It will be very helpful. And here's where I'll come back to this Westminster Dictionary of Christian Education. It's not a bibliographical tool, it's an informational one, but notice it's quite specialized. You know, it goes down the ladder towards specificity. You know, not just about religion, not just about Christianity, not just about theology, but about one branch of theology, Christian education. So you see the scale that can apply to all of the reference tools, informational and bibliographical. Notice in my examples there, under a topical subject bibliography, under subject here, I put a bibliography on religion, then one on Christianity. Notice we're moving down from general to special or specific. Then one on Presbyterianism. Finally, a bibliography of an individual denomination, like the Associate Reformed Presbyterian Church, something like that. So you've moved to the very particular and special. And just like a biobibliography was helpful to you in giving you the individual you're dealing with, so also a subject bibliography, if you're dealing with Presbyterianism, a subject bibliography on Presbyterianism would be much more helpful than a subject bibliography on religion. Although it would have material too, probably, pertaining to Presbyterianism, as would a bibliography on Christianity. So keep in mind this range. Now, the reason I didn't put biobibliography over here under subject is because it's really enumerative. If it was a subject bibliography on Albright, it would be highly specific, would it not? Check. But it would include works about Albright, possibly works by him too. But you see, we're moving over here to works about, thus the subject bibliography. Disciplines, institutions, people, places, objects, events, techniques, systems, languages, almost anything can have a subject bibliography about it, and at various levels, as I've just indicated. Let me show you a few here in the biblical field. Here's the classified bibliography of the Septuagint. Now, say, here's one for the New Testament. See? And here's one for St. John's Gospel. Here's one for the Acts of the Apostles. Notice, again, the arrangement, the descending scale toward greater and greater specificity. Now, I will take a few tools now and let you just suggest where they might fit or how the way the lines cut across here. See, this is hard to portray because the lines crisscross all the time. for example, you could have a national bibliography over there in the enumerative, a national bibliography, but that was just works on Christianity, contained works about that. So you see, it's not too hard and fast, these distinctions, although you wouldn't really have a trade bibliography that would be a subject bibliography. Again, the enumerative bibliographies tend to operate on different other criteria, commercial, political, geographic, and such. But here is McCabe's Critical Guide to Catholic Reference Books. What do you think it's are some of the determining criteria? It represents several. Well, reference books. So there you have, in a sense, a form specification for this tool. And if it just said a critical guide to reference books, it could be, you know, any of them. Theological reference books, sociology reference books, medical reference books. So, but it's limited by form. It's a critical guide, not to all the literature, just to the reference literature. And then the word Catholic narrows it by subject, you see, to those reference books which are published either by Catholics or about Catholics. And you'd have to determine it. In this case, it would be about Catholics. If it were by Catholics, it would tend to be more enumerative. But it's about Catholic material. Let's see here. Here's an index to Festschriften in Jewish studies. Now, this, an index often can kind of be a synonym for the word bibliography. Again, you have the form, Festschriften. It will not give you any material that was not published in a Festschrift, meaning a writing in honor, a book with articles in it in honor of someone, a writing on the feast or celebration, often a birthday, in Jewish studies. So it's subject. There's a subject limitation. So you see here how these crisscross, these kinds of form and subject criteria. Here's Festschriften, Jewish studies. Here's reference works, Catholic studies. Let's move on then to considerations of coverage down there below. Now, this can embrace both enumerative and subject bibliographies and to a certain extent informational tools as well. First of all, chronological considerations. E.g., 1860 to 1940. This bibliography on St. John's Gospel I held up a minute ago says St. John's Gospel, 1920 to 1965. So in other words, work by Luther, original works of Luther on St. John would not be in here. Nor would an article published, you know, last year. The time frame is delimited. Here is one on the Acts of the Apostles, which I held up a minute ago, and it covers material up through about 1961. So you notice over there at the right I have current, what is now available and retrospective, what was issued up to a specific date. Usually to be a current bibliographic tool, something has to be published in a serial form, you know, keep coming out like a periodical. Otherwise, and monographs tend to be the retrospective bibliographies. Notice the language consideration. I've already mentioned that. I give us an example here, the Cumulative Book Index, or CBI as it's sometimes known. It's an enumerative universal index, but not for non-English material. So there the language is one of the major delimiting criterion. Then I've put approach kind of in between considerations of coverage and considerations of format. And that's tricky, approach and also value. Value would be, you know, a kind of a subjective selectivity, scholarly, whatever. Approach overlaps with that somewhat. Notice popular, statistical, legal. It's not really a determinant of coverage, like chronology would be, and it's not really a determined by format, because popular is not really format. Statistical might be, but it's kind of in between there. But just kind of keep that loose and vague as kind of a consideration. You have to, it's kind of like, okay, here's the period of time that this bibliography covers, here's the languages that it embraces, and then here's its physical format, book form or whatever. Well, what else might I have to consider that the editor took into account? Then those considerations of format, serial versus monographic, we've briefly touched upon that. Serial being things that continue to come out, monographic being kind of one-shot publications. Then the physical format. And these would apply both to the bibliographies themselves and to the tools that they are covering. So that a bibliography might be serial in format. In other words, each year it comes out. But it might list only monographs. See, it would give you no bibliographic information about periodical articles or anything else. It's just books, monographs actually. So those are just things to keep in mind. As you, that basically covers the first of the three areas, nature and the levels and so on of reference tools. I hope it gives you a framework within which to approach a reference collection at any library and reference work and the handling of these things. Again, bearing in mind these kinds of criteria that you'll have to keep in mind, and the general but to the more specific, whether something serial or monographic, what the time frame is, the language, all of those kinds of things. Let's move on then to indexes, because they are a challenge. They are really a bibliography, and there are two types of them, serial and monographic. This would be a monographic index. It's called a classified bibliography, but some of the tools in the same series are called indexes. They are really a type of bibliography, but they have properties of their own somewhat. And I would now like to point out a few that we have in our library. One is Religion Index 1: Periodicals. This is the first place that I usually go in trying to find journal articles about various subjects. It has an alphabetical arrangement. You notice here, I don't know if it's on my copy, but on your copy, on physical format, I added there and arrangement. And there's basically two types of arrangement for indexes, alphabetical and classified or class. Does anybody know the difference between those? Classed or classified arrangement or bibliography and alphabetical? The classified really is also alphabetical, but the alphabetical aspect is somewhat unimportant. The alphabetical is somewhat more like the phone directory. It's like the card catalog, the subject section of a card catalog. It gives you subjects A to Z, with determined by what letter they begin with, to be very simple about it, straightforward, not determined by any hierarchy. Just many, many of them. So the first one in this subject index is probably Aaron. Yes, Aaron, the brother of Moses. And then it goes on through to the last, which is Zwingli. Just happened to be that they're people's names, but there's everything in here. If you want a biblical word, look under Greek language. If you want an article on the Gospel of Mark, look not under Mark, but under Bible New Testament Mark. And it's all alphabetical because this is computer done. Computers can't read the canon, you know, the order of the canon. They have to go by letters. So Mark comes before Matthew. But it's straight alphabetical, whereas a class index is like a Lenkis here, where it's broken down according to a hierarchy. And in a Lenkis, it's first of all bibliography, then biblical introduction, and then that's under that are canon, textual criticism, hermeneutics, then text and versions, and under that are all the various versions. Then Apocrypha, Qumran, and other such material, and under that those are broken down, Old Testament Apocrypha, New Testament Apocrypha, and so on. Then books of the Old Testament, and those are broken down according to, you know, their genre, Pentateuch, wisdom, literature, prophets, and so on. They do the same for the New Testament. Then they get into biblical history, then archaeology, geography, and so on, and then with subdivisions under that. In other words, it's a class arrangement. The alphabet's only important in that the entries underneath those headings are alphabetized, the individual articles. But the arrangement is not alphabetical otherwise. It's broken down according to a logical format, starting out with bibliography, moving on to the whole Bible, then Old Testament, and so on. So that's what classed or classified bibliography means. So this is an alphabetical type of index, and this would be a classed type. Now, I'd like to show you some of the pages here that I've put onto overhead transparencies from this Elenchus. It's Elenchus, E-L-E-N-C-H-U-S, Bibliographicus Biblicus, up in the periodical room above the back left carrel. Here is, do you want to cut out this bank of lights? Thank you, or maybe both of them. Here's that first section. You see, this ends the preliminary matter, which is very important to give you abbreviations and that kind of thing. And this begins the first section. Again, your class arrangement doesn't begin with the name Aaron. It begins with a bibliography on material. And the first thing they have there is Aykroyd's Foreign Theological Literature Survey for those 2 years, published on the Old Testament, published in Expository Times. Again, if you need to know what those abbreviations are, go back to the key, the volume, the year, the pages, and then this was a continued article in two sections, so the second half of it was in the next volume, so on. What does this bold face mean? That means it's a book. And some books are included. Now, this will not include any books. Again, your criteria of coverage, no books, just periodical articles. Whereas this includes some book. What does that asterisk mean? Nothing. As our wonderful friend, if I can find him, Stanley Merrow says, the asterisk after a number has no meaning for the user. It is the editor's convenient device to make last-minute additions without disrupting the numerical sequence after the galleys are set. So, you know, you wonder about some of these things. You have to check out a bibliographic guide, a tool that will tell you in an annotation how to use the thing, or go to the beginning Probably in all this beginning material, he will not tell you that. And so that's just an example of how the thing runs. Notice it begins with one and runs up through a couple of thousand entries. And retrieval from the other indexes at the end, which I'll show you in a minute, is by entry number. So in the back, if you look under author and find out what Aykroyd published during these years, this index, it would list Aykroyd, his name, and then there'd be the number one, meaning the first, not page one, but the first entry. Now let's move on, and I'll show you the section on Hebrew words. Notice we're up to 8,000 in the entries. They get to the words, and because of the way they're alphabetized here, they put the entry numbers over here. It's not inconvenient, really. Just keep your eye out for them. But notice, here's your Hebrew words, alphabetized by Hebrew character. This is not done by computers so that they can do this. This thing used to do it by the Hebrew characters. Once they went on computer, they had to go to transliteration, because the computer can handle Roman script, but not, you know, Semitic Hebrew script. Okay, let's move on then to the index. Remember I said there were indexes at the back of the thing to help you unlock the tool. Well, this is the first index, author, anonymous works, collections, Festschriften, and all kinds of things would be here. In fact, I just noticed in preparing for this that volume 57, 1956, the index is broken down differently than it is for the 1974 volume, in which I went through and translated the Latin for all the headings. So you'll use this, and there will be slightly different headings.
Please turn the cassette over at this point.
They've divided this up a little differently. They lumped everything together more before. Now it's divided a little bit. But to see here, there's Aykroyd. There's number one. Remember, number one was an article by him. Entry three, the next entry by him wasn't until 1,148. But see, that's how you'd go back and retrieve it from the body of the tool. I was wondering if there's... Oh, yeah, I should point out... Well, here's a little code up here to some of these, you know, the things here. But I wanted to find an R after here. That means a review. Person, it was a review that's indexed. It handles some reviews. Well, here, let's put on this section here for the scripture. Here's, before they lumped the scripture all together with the other index. Now they've divided it up. So if you're dealing with Exodus 2:10, citation number 2370 is an article on Exodus 2:10. So you have your scripture index, then you have your word indexes again. Oh, what did I do? I duplicated those twice, sorry. Here are the Hebrew words. Now notice you have to go both places to cover all of the Hebrew words. Here's back, this is the discussions of Hebrew words under the biblical philology section of the bulk of the index. Notice the first one is Ava, an article by J.B. Scott. You notice you go over to your Hebrew words index at the back of the book, and Ava is not there. So there's not necessarily overlap. You have to consult both the philology section under the Hebrew words and then the Hebrew words index at the back. Notice they have Eblaite words, Ugaritic words, Phoenician words, Aramaic words. They have Syriac, if there are any, which is actually a sub-language of Aramaic. Akkadian, Sumerian, Arabic, Ethiopic, Egyptian. Notice all of these are in transliteration except the Hebrew the Coptic, and the Greek. There's your, for the New Testament people, there's your Greek word. Abrobates is an article that pertains to that word, citation 7958. And then, again, or when even the Gothic here is transliterated, of course, but then the Latin, of course, would not be. But except for Coptic, Hebrew, Greek, and Latin, those languages, words are transliterated. I hope that helps you understand the enormous value of this tool. You can read other descriptions about it in Mero and so on, books that give you not just the lists of the works, but give you abstracts. Then there's New Testament Abstracts. It's another one of the major indexes. It's published three times a year. You can kind of see the three-way breakdown there. And each issue begins, again, a classed arrangement. So the first section is New Testament General, general material on the New Testament. And it includes book reviews as well as periodical articles. Here's a review by J.A. Fitzmyer of Robinson's two books, the famous Redating the New Testament, and your abstract. Now, you see, Alenkis didn't have any abstracts. You all know what an abstract is or an annotation. It's a description of the material, not just the citation, you know, author, title, place, and date, but it gives you more. It tells you what it's about. And so this tells you basically what Fitzmyer said in his review about Robinson. There's another review by Smith of Robinson's Redating the New Testament. Okay, then in the last of the three issues, there is an index to all three, which constitute a bibliographic volume, which we bind together thus. And there, in each issue, I'm getting ahead of myself. In each issue, there are also book notices. Here you see the same class arrangement, but the books are separated out. And there's the books listed by author or by title, if there's no author as such. And then the abstract of the books. And here's what's at the end of each volume, at the end of the third issue. A scripture index and an author index. There's James Barr. Again, it's by citation number, not page number. Barr has an article listed at 665 and a review, that little R means review, at 675. And then, lastly, there's an index of book reviews. Notice there are not very many reviews indexed, considering the huge number of reviews that are published. That's why I like this thing, which at the back of it has a completely separate review section. This is the index of book reviews at the back of it. And then an index of the book notices by the author. So in other words, if you want some books on Romans, this wouldn't be helpful to you. This would only be helpful if you want to find out, get an abstract of a book by a person that you're studying, like Beasley Murray, Hobbes and Robbins, Revelation, three viewpoints. If you can get access to the thing by that, but if otherwise, you'd have to look under the Revelation section of the classified arrangement to come across the material. I'm going to move on, except to say that this is now on computer with the Bibliographic Retrieval Services, known as BRS. It's also hoping to go on to Dialog, which is another computer database. And with the computer, you can lump things together. So if you want to study something about the exegesis of Hebrews as influenced or related to Philo in some fashion, rather than going to Philo and going over every article about him and seeing if there's anything there pertaining to exegesis or Hebrews, then going to Hebrews and going through every article there and seeing if there's anything that might remotely pertain to Philo of Alexandria, you can lump all those things together and it'll cull out everything that's irrelevant to your purpose. So it'll give you a listing of just the things pertaining to Philonic vis-a-vis Hebrews exegetical study. Okay, I guess we can have the lights again, and I will move on to a brief, just before we finish indexes, I'd like to mention series, what series are. This book here is a list of, it says, books in series published in the United States. Series usually are, scholarly series are often put out by a scholarly society or a journal as a supplement to it, but they are a series of monographs, usually, coming out often annually or irregularly, about unified by some theme, like New Testament or whatever. Studies in Biblical Theology, Supplements to Novum Testamentum. Those are scholarly series. And I'd like to hand out the photocopies of columns from two different pages in that thing, Books in Series in the United States. Again, this is just U.S. published series. And these photocopies show the series under Bible and the series under theology. Notice under Bible over there at the left, the first is Bible-Antiquities. The first series they give is Baker Studies in Biblical Archaeology. Notice under Belief and Doubt there happens to be a series entitled Science and Belief, from Copernicus to Darwin. That would be interesting. Each monograph would pertain to those subjects. Then Bible-Commentaries, Cambridge Bible Commentary, Everyman's, Hermea, so on. You notice how incomplete it is. It doesn't include the expositors, that new expositor. Now, possibly because none of the volumes have emerged yet, but there certainly are other series. Broadman Bible Commentary is not there, maybe because it's completed. You know, it's questionable whether a multi-volume thing that comes over a period of years is actually a series or, you know, one title that just is published over a period of years. What's that? Tyndale Old Testament commentaries are omitted. Yes. Are they published by an American company too? I know they're. Okay. They should be here because they're published by InterVarsity. I can see why they'd be omitted if the main publisher is Potter and Stoughton or whoever in Britain does them. But you see, you have to take into account those kinds of criteria for inclusion or omission. Notice over in the third column under theology there in the middle, a huge list. I'm surprised the Gifford lectures are there. I did not study the criteria to these. Under theology-bibliography, I am familiar with those. The American Theological Library Association's bibliography and monograph series are both there. But it gives you an idea as to what these series are. And this tool then would give you each of those series, as books in series in the U.S., and list the individual titles under those series. It's a way to study, to find related material on your topic, if you can find a series that deals with that. Okay, let's move finally and quickly as possible to Old and New Testament exegesis and the commentaries. And, oh, before I do that, I knew I had overplanned this. I'll just pass these out and comment upon them with one sentence each. What Dr. Peterson is passing out is a list of indexes to journals in the field of religion. And Al Tricarico has a chart showing the spans of some of these journals, and Dr. Newman has a list of criteria to consider as you evaluate given indexes. Now, we're talking about indexes to journals. We're not talking about the journals themselves. On the first thing that Dr. Newman handed out, it's called Abstracting and Indexing Services. Please put dash in religion or related to religion. Because this is a tiny fraction of the indexing services that there are. This comes from Religious Books and Serials in Print, which is this volume here. This is like Books in Print, except it calls out just the religious titles. Plus includes some more, or some less known publishers. But notice here, Mr. Dunswater asked me the other day about Judaica studies and Jewish studies. And I gave him this photocopy and circled several indexes. Notice at the bottom of the first column at the left, index to articles on Jewish studies. So obviously, if you're going to deal with Jewish studies, it'd be helpful to know that there exists a whole periodical index devoted just to that field. Notice the third index listed at the top of the second column. Index to Jewish periodicals. Again, another index devoted just to the Jewish-related periodicals. So if you're studying Judaica, knowing about these things is, well, virtually indispensable if you're going to be serious about it. Now, that does not mean that numbers of these other indexes would not have vast information about Judaica, but it just means that there are indexes devoted specifically to those fields. The second thing that was handed out, Al's handout, shows the spans of certain indexes. I don't have any copies of that, but from that you can see literature, and you're going to say, oh boy, I'm going to go back and find out everything Robert Dick Wilson published in various journals. Then you get to using the thing, you find out it began in 1949, and Wilson died years before. You see what I mean? You've got to take those kinds of considerations into account in using them. Now, as you see here, it's cross out 16. This time spans of 16. I think I added, there's 19 now. I added 3. 19, General Religious Periodical Indexes. You see the overlap and the time frames involved. So there's a lot of spottiness of coverage. And that's where these monographic retrospective indexes, like if you're dealing with Acts and you come across this, it gives you all that journal information up through 1961. Then you say, oh, it doesn't matter so much if Religion Index 1 doesn't go before 1949 because this covers Acts material up through 61, and then I can pick up those stuff in the last 20 years through the periodical indexes. Now, just to blow your mind a little bit more with this time span thing, take Religious Index to Religious Periodical Literature, which is now Religion Index 1. It's the sixth, title down. Within it, you see its time span there. Within it, for each periodical indexed, there will probably be a different time span. Check. So even though Bibliotheca Sacra was published all through the 1950s, if this didn't start indexing Bibliotheca Sacra till 1963... you're not going to find any Bibliotheca Sacra stuff in it, even though you go to the front of the most recent volume and say, oh, yeah, it indexes Bibliotheca Sacra, and start going all the way back through. Once you get before 1963, you're not going to find any articles under your subject on atonement or whatever from the Bib Sac, even though you thought you might. And each periodical it indexes varies as the years go on, because periodicals come into existence, and then they're indexed. Christianity Today came into existence after this began publication. Obviously, it wouldn't index Christianity Today before 1956 because Christianity Today didn't exist before 1956. You see what I mean? And what if Christianity Today ceased publication in 1976? Well, obviously, this wouldn't index it because it ceased publication. Or for another reason, it may have dropped it. Say Christianity Today came into existence in 1956 and they didn't think it would be as monumental a journal as it was, so they didn't start indexing it until 1961. The first 5 inches years of Christianity Day then wouldn't be indexed. See, you see, there's all these kinds of convoluted patterns in terms of the indexing coverage of any given journal and so on. If you want to study the Southern Baptist, don't think, oh, I'm going to study the Southern Baptist, I'll go and use this. You'll only get certain things. What you'd want then is the Southern Baptist Periodical Index, which covers all the state conventions, newsletters, magazines, all of the theological seminaries, journals, you see. Only a select few of their seminary journals probably would be indexed in here. So again, think of your general to specific, and of your breadth of coverage, and of your chronology. And then the last thing that was handed out is just a list of criteria to consider in using any index or abstract. Most of those criteria I have already covered. So we will move on then to the third thing, which is Old Testament, New Testament, exegesis, and commentaries. This, of course, could be a whole semester study in itself. I would recommend that you have in your library, if you have anything else, Douglas Stewart, Old Testament Exegesis. Douglas Stewart, Old Testament Exegesis. And he says that this book is for the vast majority of all seminary students and pastors. It is predicated on the conviction that even the most intelligent people cannot understand procedures and concepts that are not somehow explained to them, and that there is no shame in seeking such explanations in spite of the fact that most seminary professors do not volunteer them. Old Testament exegesis has regular procedures and concepts, and these can be taught to almost anyone willing to learn. It is a tragedy that so few seminary students ever really feel sure of themselves in doing Old Testament exegesis, and most pastors apparently abandon the practice altogether. So I'd recommend his tool, and you notice at the very beginning, he says four tools especially valuable for the methodological and bibliographic guidance they contain relating to exegesis, and there'd be analogs for New Testament exegesis, and some of this overlaps with New Testament as well, and a lot of the principles, of course, embrace both. You should own all four. First is Otto Eisfeldt, the Old Testament, and an introduction. It's checked out of the library, but I have here the German edition buried here somewhere. Here it is. This is the first edition. You want the English translation of the third edition. The second thing is Donker's basic or multipurpose tools for Bible study. He says, Donker provides backgrounds, definitions, and explanations for all sorts of books, methods, sources, and styles in biblical exegesis. His work is the standard resource for such information. Then thirdly, Solon, which we have on reference in the library. Solon's Handbook of Biblical Criticism. The handbook is a collection of definitions. Virtually all the exegetical terms and techniques you'll ever run across are fully explained by Solon. And fourth and last, my good friend who I just have held up a few times already, Stanley Merrow, Basic Tools of Biblical Exegesis. I think Merrow surpasses all of the others. It's not a bibliography. In the preface, he read prefaces to things. It's not just, and I also want to thank Ruth Whitaker for reading the manuscript and Sally Gumbo for typing and all that. It's a lot more. And he tells you, it's Basic Tools of Biblical Exegesis by Stanley B. Merrow, M-A-R-R-O-W. In fact, it itself is part of a series. Remember, we just talked about series a minute. It's number two in the Subsidia Biblica series. Kind of, subsidiary or helpful works relating to biblical study. Published in Rome by the Biblical Institute Press, 1978. But it's annotated. He's the place where I learned that those asterisks and Alenkis don't mean anything. Okay, except to the galley setter. Okay, this is an excellent tool. Dr. Newman requires Scholler's work. One part of this was going to be, and I'm glad because of the time I didn't now, but going to be a presentation of what are the standard editions of the Septuagint and the Vulgate and this and that. I mentioned the standard edition of the Samaritan Pentateuch. I was going to go through and take all the various literature that you need and basic sources and give you your standard editions of such, like this is for the Samaritan Pentateuch. And I decided not to do that because really, Merrow and Scholler and Donker and these people cover that very, very nicely. And these are both annotated. Scholler doesn't annotate every listing. He actually introduces them with little remarks. But they're both very good. Commentaries, my last point before questions and some answers maybe. People always ask me, what are good commentaries? Well, it depends on what you want. Some people rave about Spurgeon's commenting and commentaries, and they say that it's still an excellent tool, even though it's over 100 years out of date now. I mean, it was published in 1876. This is just a reprinting. So in other words, anything published in the last 110 years wouldn't be in here, commented upon. And it is good. He talks a lot about some of the older classic pre-critical works. But if you want devotional, homiletical kind of insights on things, well, yes, it's fairly good. But if you want more recent stuff, as I said, or critical considerations, it's marginal. For example, about a life of Christ, biographies of Christ, he says about one of the biographers, he said, any life of Christ is like doing a picture of the sunset in charcoal. In other words, you can't do it. And Spurgeon says, beautiful comment, in effect, the life of the Christian is the only true picture of the life of Christ. Well, that's nice, but if you're wanting to know a good analysis of biographies of Christ, it's not helpful. And on an exposition of one of the Pauline epistles, Spurgeon says the author, unfortunately, devotes practically all of his attention to the view that the Pope is Antichrist and loses exposition of the epistle in the process. However, that point is an extremely important one in itself. In other words, he's commending the work for the fact that it doesn't really give you any exposition of the epistle, but it is a strong presentation of the fact that the Pope is Antichrist. Well, again, I wouldn't buy a commentary like that. I mean, despite Spurgeon saying that that's an important point and makes the thing valuable in itself. So you have to kind of consider your purposes and your need. The Minister's Library is a popular one done by Thurl Barber, who's been helping build the Campus Crusade Seminary's library out in California. Thurl Barber, I think he just left that post. But he's an evangelical bibliographer. But Brevard Childs, in his work, The Old Testament Books for Pastor and Teacher, says something which Keppel picks up on in his book about Barber. By the way, this is Barber now has the fourth supplement. Some of them have the first one published in bound in with them, but there are supplements that have kept the thing up to date, which is very nice. But let me read here. I had it marked, and I pulled out that paper and looked at it, wondered what it was, and threw it away. Now I realized at the critical moment it was my mark of the page. Here you go. Keppel, librarian at Westminster, says, Brevard Child's evaluation that, quote, Barber's advice is very misleading. Barber seems mainly concerned with the orthodoxy of the author, and he has little judgment of quality, end quote, is unfortunately correct. And I tend to agree with Childs as a moderately liberal scholar and as with Keppel as a conservative, that it does tend to be more concerned with the orthodoxy of the author. But it's an excellent place to go for a listing of the works. Unfortunately, it doesn't give you the initial time of publication, so you'll find an 18th century thing with a date, publication date, 1972 and stuff. But it does give you little insights onto things, and he'll tell you whether something's dispensational or whether something's liberal but valuable for its historical material and that kind of thing. So these things, what I'm trying to say is these things have their purposes. It depends on what you're after. Brevard Child's Old Testament Books for Pastor and Teacher. I would recommend that you read that if you don't buy it. He, for one thing, goes through all of the Old Testament books and discusses commentaries on them at length. Here, for example, Song of Solomon, he spends 3 pages on the material on the Song of Solomon. Valuable resource, insightful. He kind of critiques the use of Kittel's TDNT. It gets into the whole thing with the linguistic versus word study problem. Dr. Peterson and John Picard are up on that. The whole thing with James Barn, the semantics of biblical research, which I read back in seminary, but forget most of the critique now, but I agree with it anyway. If you want to know, have an Old Testament commentary survey in itself, this is helpful. Golding Gay. These will all be up here for you to look at. They're all in the library, and I'll help you retrieve them if you need. They all have cards in the catalog and so on. Old Testament Commentary Survey by John Golding Gay, Gold, I-N-G-A-Y, Golding Gay. Again, goes through Old Testament books and lists various commentaries on them. And the same thing for the New Testament by Anthony Thiselton, T-H-I-S-E-L-T-O-N. Thiselton, T-H-I-S-E-L-T-O-N, Anthony Thiselton. New Testament Commentary Survey does the same thing. I find it mixed. It's quite up to date. It covers a lot of recently published things. But, you just have to be your own man and find out what's helpful for you and what your needs are. You know, are you in a rural parish and a place where, you need a lot of the rich homey illustrations and things drawn out of certain denominational backgrounds or something to bring to your congregation? Or are you teaching at a Bible college somewhere, where you need maybe something like in your preaching or your teaching that is more analytical, relates to the language study more? It depends on your purposes. Then France, R.T. France, A Bibliographical Guide to New Testament Research. It's fairly good, too. That essentially concludes my presentation. Oh, I want to mention John Bollier. I've met Bollier. He's at Yale. B-O-L-L-I-E-R. The Literature of Theology, A Guide for Students and Pastors. It's very good, too. Keppel, Bollier, K-E-P-P-L-E. Keppel's the librarian at Westminster. There's reference works for theological research. All of these are very good tools. Donker, of course. Dr. Quick had an excellent presentation, which we have on tape because his entire course was taped, including his library part. But he went into some of the practical difficulties with certain tools. For example, I learned a lot from his presentation. He pointed out that the parsing guide by Hahn to the New Testament has a lot of errors and inaccuracies in the parsings, and therefore can be a problem. He pointed out the value of Thayer. In fact, in many cases, he would prefer Thayer to Arnton Gingrich because of the direct meaning location and its complete treatment of Koine Greek and the synonyms given at the end of the articles. So reference to Trench, for example, wouldn't be necessary. I so often see students just buying things willy-nilly. Oh, I buy Trench because somebody said that's good and I'll get Thayer and I'll get, and actually they have things that are actually quite uneven in quality and very different in overlap. It's just totally uncritical purchasing. Quek personally believed that Moulton and Milligan was far preferable to Englishman's Greek. And now McCrae raves about Englishman's Hebrew concordance. But I presume that Quek would say the same thing about Mandelkern and Lasowski, the Old Testament Hebrew concordances, that he would about Moulton and Milligan, that really, if you get into it seriously, they're preferable to the Englishman's Greek and Hebrew. Moulton and Geddon, I'm sorry. Oh, that's horrendous. Moulton and Geddon. I think most of you know what Moulton and Geddon is. He's on Vine's Expository Dictionary. He said, F.F. Bruce in the foreword says there's no book quite like it, which can mean different things. Dr. Quick says it's a poor man's Kittle, interestingly. It unfortunately uses transliterations. I hate transliterations, by the way. He says Ralph Septuagint's a sine qua non for New Testament students. He said that he knows of a seminary which gives a one-credit course on how to use Nestle's critical apparatus, and thus he recommends Souter. He feels the UBS text is too subjective and selective with their apparatus and their readings. He complimented the Living Bible as often a beautiful paraphrase, not that bad a thing. Often you'll hear it dumped on, of course. He complimented the Catholic Biblical Encyclopedia as an excellent exegetical work, compared to many liberal Protestant biblical encyclopedias. And in fact, he says there's not any mention of Mary's Immaculate Conception in the article on the virgin birth. And you know, there's not really that much Catholic coloration of the Catholic Biblical Encyclopedia. So don't let the fact that it's a Catholic tool keep you from buying certain reference tools. He complimented the New Bible Dictionary as a sine qua non, especially in its three-volume illustrated edition. Hastings Dictionary of the Bible is good, although he said it. One of the reasons he feels it's good is that too much recent liberal commentary material is very faddish. For example, John McNeill's commentary on Romans. He talked about the various concordances, like Hatch and Redpath give you. This is one reason why he preferred Moulton and Gedon and Hatch and Redpath and so on to the English works. If you're studying Huios Theou, Hatch and Redpath will give you that every place that occurs. Whereas, sorry about that, Englishmen, you'll have to go through all the occurrences of Huios and see wherever any of them have Theou with them. See the convenience of the collocation of phrases and major things like that, certainly a major word arrangement that some of these more scholarly tools will provide. Englishman's does not have that arrangement, for example. He did compliment Kittle's TDNT as having a mine of information. In fact, he said Bruce feels good about that, despite, you know, Barr's criticism and the hesitancy in the usefulness of some of that. That pertains to an ongoing debate about linguistics and word studies and so on. Colin Brown's New International Dictionary of New Testament Theology. Colin Brown, he said, lived in the library at Trinity College in Bristol while he was working on that, and Queck visited him there at his desk. The presentation was chock full of fascinating first-hand insights like that. It's theological more than linguistic, but takes into account transformational grammar. He said that is Eugene Nida's rehabilitation of Chomsky's transformational grammar. The New International Dictionary of New Testament Theology, I asked him, I said, isn't that a translation or a reworking of a German original which was not evangelical? And he says, yes, the original German work on which Colin Brown's New Testament Dictionary is based was not evangelical, but Brown revises it a lot and makes it generally evangelical. And again, it's not fixated on words, but it mentions and takes into account Barr's criticisms. That's it. Sorry to run way over.